Another busy day. This is the last, I would remind the listeners, right at the very outset of Issues, Etc., this is the last regular program of Issues, Etc. for this week. We will be beginning Share-a-thon 2003 tomorrow, and that will be what you're going to be hearing during this hour and the remainder of the program day here on AM 850 KFUO. And we do encourage you to tune in and listen for Share-a-thon 2003, and also to give us a phone call and support the gospel outreach of AM 850 KFUO. This being the last hour, we're going to try and pack in as much as we possibly can, the last 3 hours of Issues, Etc. for the week, as much as we possibly can into 3 hours, and I think we'll do a good job here. We're going to start out talking with Robert Knight, Director of Culture and Family Studies for Concerned Women for America. If you've been watching the papers or the news, you have certainly heard about the reaction from all quarters to statements made several weeks ago by Senator Rick Santorum, Republican from Pennsylvania. We're going to find out precisely what he said and what has been the reaction. What are we to make of his comments in the news? That's the first half hour of the program. In the second half hour, Scott Klusendorf joins us to address another issue that's in the news. That is Lacey Peterson, her unborn son, and the abortion issue. Cal Thomas has written an interesting article on this, and others are commenting. This is a difficult one because it has to do with a real inconsistency in California law. And I'm of mixed feelings on this, but I'll talk to Scott Klusendorf about that in the second half hour of the program today. Lacey Peterson, the whole case. Then, in the second hour of the program, one solid hour with Bob Leko of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit. Two issues. Are Christians little gods? Paul Crouch of the Trinity Broadcasting Network, for the second time, not for the second time, for the latest time, I should say, in mid-March, proclaimed himself to be a little god. And he's not the only one. What in the world does Crouch mean when he says this? And where did this teaching come from? The other thing we'll talk about with Bob Leko is a dispute between the Planning Commission of Costa Mesa, California, and the Trinity Broadcasting Network. Two related issues in the second hour of Issues, Etc. Hour three brings us two guests. First, one of our favorites, Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute. We'll talk about the fake cloning bill in the U.S. Senate and what it would do if it were to pass, and what needs to be done in order to completely prevent all human cloning. And then in the final half hour of the program, Dr. James Dretke of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies joins us. We're going to talk about this pilgrimage within Iraq that has suddenly taken place because of sudden religious freedom in that formerly unfree country. More than 1 million Muslims yesterday marched in Karbala, Iraq. We'll find out why and what it means in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. today. Our phone numbers during the whole 3 hours, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Robert Knight is Director of Culture and Family Studies for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Bob, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
What exactly did Senator Rick Santorum say several weeks ago to the Associated Press?
Well, he was talking about the Texas sodomy case, Lawrence v. Texas, and he said, quote, "If the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything," unquote. Now, the Associated Press stuck the word gay just before the word sex, between consensual, because that's what this case is all about, and that made it more sensationalistic than it had to be. You know, the senator was right on target. He's basically saying that if the Supreme Court says that the Constitution prevents a state from governing sexual activity on the grounds of public health or morality, then any law about sexual activity is up for grabs. I'm surprised he didn't add prostitution to that list, because if the ruling is that no state can have anything to say about consensual sex behind closed doors of any kind, then why not prostitution?
You know, I want to come back to that, because that was precisely my thought when I heard about this. First of all, this insertion of the word gay in brackets there before consensual sex in Senator Santorum's comments, as they appeared in the Associated Press Wire report, was this, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and think this was perhaps just an attempt to clarify. Did it misrepresent what Senator Santorum intended to say, do you think?
I think he was making the broader point, and that kind of focused it on the gay angle, which is probably what the Associated Press wanted to happen. I'm questioning their credibility, but they do have a plausible explanation as well, that they thought that would clarify what's at stake to the readers. So, you know, I'm more interested in the political fallout from this.
Well, what has been the political fallout? How would you characterize that?
Well, you've got the Log Cabin Republicans, that's a gay activist group trying to get inside the Republican Party, calling for Rick Santorum stepping down from his leadership post. He's number three man in the Senate. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. These guys are always talking about a big tent for the Republican Party, but here they're trying to take the head off one of its bright, young, rising stars, all because he said something they don't happen to like. So that shows how vicious their agenda is. It's not really about the good of the Republican Party. It's about advancing the homosexual agenda. So I always call them a homosexual pressure group or homosexual activists. The other thing is you have now two Republican senators criticizing Senator Santorum, and that's Susan Collins of Maine and Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. No surprise they come from liberal New England. I'm from Maine myself, so I'm deeply ashamed whenever Susan Collins does something like this. But I'm not overly surprised. She's on the extreme in her support of the homosexual agenda. She doesn't represent mainstream Republicans or Americans on these issues. So I don't think Senator Santorum really has that much to worry about.
This has, in other quarters, also been compared to recent comments made by former, let me see if I can get my timeline straight. Wasn't Senate Majority, was he?
He was Senate Majority
Trent
Leader. Yeah.
It's been compared to Trent Lott's recent comments regarding segregation in the 40s. Is this comparison apt?
Well, first, I think Trent Lott got railroaded. I think his comments, he should have known his comments would be taken the way they were. He didn't make any direct comments about race. But even if he did, it shouldn't be compared to what Senator Santorum has discussed. If you take the worst interpretation of Senator Lott's remarks, you can say, wow, he's out of line. But if you look at Senator Santorum's remarks, he's right on target. He's making a valid legal point that has been discussed by legal scholars about the full impact of such a ruling that might happen. And he stood for the family. In subsequent statements, he said there is a moral imperative for the state to support family life and to discourage other forms of sexual activity. And that's for the good of society. It's for the good of children. And it's for the good of us all, really, when it comes down to it. So, you know, to compare that to Senator Lott getting bounced, basically, for making what appeared to be a racist statement is just a typical tactic the homosexual activists use with their media allies to smear good people.
I guess the next logical question on the Trent Lott comparison is, will Senator Santorum's fate be the same as that of Trent Lott?
No, and I think there was a good signal in that regard sent by Senator Bill Frist, who is the U.S. Senate Majority Leader. He just had a very terse reaction, and he said, quote, "Rick is a consistent voice for inclusion and compassion in the Republican Party and in the Senate, and to suggest otherwise is just politics." He's saying a few things by doing this. First, it's a one-sentence statement, meaning I don't really regard this as that troubling or important, so I'm just going to toss it off like this. The other is that he's saying Santorum, who has brought new voters into the Republican Party, Hispanics and blacks in Pennsylvania, is for inclusion and compassion, and that's what it should mean, not promoting the homosexual agenda. So if the Senate Majority Leader is satisfied to just toss off a comment and pretty much dismiss this whole thing, I don't think Senator Santorum has anything to worry about. I think it's going to backfire on the Log Cabin Republicans for going after one of the best and brightest Republican senators.
On the general comparison with racism, I've been reading stories all across the papers today regarding this, and several, I think more or less, you know, from special interest groups, have been saying these amount to or directly related to racist comments, not making the comparison with Lott, but simply saying this is as bad as racism,
yeah,
what Santorum said.
Oh, that's nonsense. Standing up for traditional values, believing that sex should be channeled into marriage and not into homosexual relationships is not like racism. First, race is something people can't change. They're born with it. There is no moral content, whether you're black, white, Hispanic, Oriental. You're born that way. But sexuality, what you do with your sexuality brings all sorts of moral choices. It becomes a moral issue. So the comparison of race with sexuality is totally wrong. And it's a convenient misdirection of the moral capital of the black civil rights movement to the gay rights activist movement. And, of course, they have nothing in comparison. Blacks suffered slavery and then labored under Jim Crow laws in this country. Homosexuals have never been treated like that. They're one of the highest income groups in the country. They hold some of the best jobs. They have more disposable income. They have vast political power for their numbers. They're not remotely connected to the train that had to ride through Selma and proclaim that black people needed some more freedom and from oppression. So, I mean, they're really hijacking the civil rights movement. And black people really ought to be upset about it, especially God-fearing black people who know that God said homosexuality is wrong.
We're talking with Robert Knight, Director of Culture and Family Studies for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the controversy surrounding recent remarks made by Senator Rick Santorum in an interview with the Associated Press. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Bob, has there been any reaction from the White House? If not, need there be any?
No, I think the White House, well, actually, it would do President Bush well to stand by Senator Santorum and say, hey, he's a good man. He's saying things that we all believe. He's not singling out a particular group. He is saying that this is the legal principle involved, that if you say a state can't regulate this, then forget all these other sexual categories. It'd be nice if we had a president who could articulate family values like that. And I wish he would, but I doubt he will.
Why is that?
He's uncomfortable with the homosexual issue. The president has said some wonderful things in the pro-life area. He's led us to victory in Iraq. But on the homosexual issue, the administration has been drifting toward promoting homosexuality. They've done it by not overturning any of Bill Clinton's executive orders that added sexual orientation in various areas of the federal government, appointing 30 openly gay officials, meeting with the log cabin Republicans and according them that kind of respect and validity, appointing homosexuals to head the AIDS Commission, and letting Jerry Thacker, a good Christian man who has the AIDS virus himself, just get hammered and thrown out by the press, and even kicking him while he was on his way out. The administration has been very bad on the homosexual issue, and somebody needs to tell the president he has to be a moral leader on all those issues, not just the life issue.
The U.S. Constitution in the Fourth Amendment gives people a protection against unlawful search and seizure, sometimes called a right to privacy. However, I've heard the Santorum comments, and in particular homosexual activity, consensual activity within the home, fall under what appears to be a broader right to privacy. Does such a right to privacy exist in the U.S. Constitution?
No, it doesn't, and it was a fabrication by the courts. In fact, the right to privacy originated in the sanctity of marriage, the idea that the government did stop at the bedroom door, and what a married couple did was nobody's business but theirs. They took that and they transported that to legitimize first birth control, sales to non-married couples, first to married couples, then to non-married couples. Then they took it all the way to Roe v. Wade, creating a larger sphere of privacy, saying it was a woman's right to choose. Now they're saying that the right to privacy that solely existed in the sanctity of marriage is now applied to homosexual sodomy. And who knows what else? I mean, Senator Santorum had it right when he said, you know, if the laws against sodomy are declared unconstitutional, then there's no reason they shouldn't go after laws in polygamy and bigamy and incest. And I wish he'd said prostitution.
You raised the issue of prostitution. That came to my mind as well. And the first thing that occurs to me is prostitution is consensual, but it is, in most states, illegal. Why would you make the comparison?
Well, because it is consensual. So where do you draw the line? Just because money is exchanged doesn't mean it's not any less consensual. And so I can't see any moral reason if you said the state has no business ever in regulating sexuality in any way, how can you rein in prostitution? In fact, how can you rein in hardcore pornography, for that matter, even if it destroys communities and enslaves men and makes women objects? They'll say, well, tough. It's all consensual, so anything goes. That's the libertarian outlook, that the government should, quote, stay out of the bedroom. The problem with that is, yeah, we don't want the bedroom police. Nobody wants that. And that's not what has been the history of the sodomy laws in this country. The government has not used that to kick down the bedroom door, ever. That case in Dallas that triggered this Lawrence v. Texas case, it was very suspicious. They got a false alarm. Police came in, and these guys were apparently engaged in sex together. And then here's the most interesting part that hasn't been reported. They continued in their activities even while the police were there. Now, does that sound like normal conduct to you? It sounds like they were setting up a challenge to the law. And as we know, hard cases make bad law. You know, you'll find one instance like that. Well, it does sound kind of unfair. The police answer a false alarm, and these guys wind up charged. But then you look at all the good sodomy laws do. And, you know, to tear them all down because of a case like that would be like getting rid of speed limits because a cop happened to stop a guy with his pregnant wife on the way to the hospital, and maybe she miscarried. So I guess we better get rid of all speed limits because of that. They're not looking at the broader picture. And sodomy laws are a marker for society. They say this behavior is unhealthy, it's immoral, and it doesn't support family life. So therefore, it's not protected under the Constitution.
Or are prostitution, which is illegal in most states, and homosexuality, whose legality or the legality of which is in question here, are they moral equivalents?
Well, they're not. And all those things are sexual misconduct. But, you know, a lot of times I've heard the Texas case characterized as, you want to put gay people in jail for being gay. Nonsense. The law only targets homosexual acts themselves. It doesn't matter what orientation the person is. If two heterosexuals decide to experiment, they're just as in violation of the law as two homosexuals doing it, or some convicts in prison who do it temporarily. It's the activity. And this idea that they built an identity around sexual orientation is the problem. There is no such thing as sexual orientation. It was cooked up by the gay activist movement to try to create an identity that could be included in the civil rights groups. And also, it is a direct attack on the Christian view of sexuality. A lot of people don't realize that. They think it's kind of neutral. You know, you have a sexual orientation, and I have one, and everybody does. It's not so. The Christian view is that God gave us sexuality. We can misuse it or not. We're all sinners. We all need redemption. And sexual orientation says you don't need redemption. There is no such thing as sin. Anything you feel like doing is okay because that's your orientation. This is a radical challenge to the Christian view of life, and yet most Christians don't realize that. And they've stood by as sexual orientation policies have been added all over this country. It's time to roll them back and get them off the books because they have no business distorting the civil rights laws.
In the few minutes left to us, Bob, these homosexual activist groups, Lambda, the Human Rights Campaign has been the most vocal on the Santorum comments. Tell us about them. What's the agenda here?
Well, I'm glad you brought them up because here's something people ought to know. Mark Roscoe, the Republican chairman, met with the Human Rights Campaign and 300 gay activists in March, which was a very unwise thing to do. It was the first time a GOP chair had met with this gay activist group or any gay activist group. He talked about the politics of inclusion and so forth. Think about this for a minute. Human Rights Campaign is a hard left, pretty democratic organization that supported Al Gore, had him speak at their fundraisers, supports the entire liberal democratic agenda. And there's the Republican chairman basically saying we must have some common ground. I don't see any common ground. I don't see him meeting with groups that are trying to raise taxes, for instance, or undermine other parts of the Republican agenda. You just don't see that. So why are they dancing toe-to-toe with the homosexual activists?
Well, why?
Well, I think they have a misguided... I think here's their cynical calculation. Christian conservatives have nowhere else to go. They're going to vote GOP. They love President Bush. They see him as one of us. And so therefore, if they slide on this homosexual issue, it's not going to make that much difference, and it might bring in suburban... women who want the GOP to have a more compassionate facade. So their idea of showing compassion is giving in to the homosexual activism. as if that's a form of compassion. I think that's the calculation, actually. Plus, a lot of the Republicans don't have the courage or the knowledge to stand up and debate this topic. You know, you got to have a good, strong foundation and know that homosexuality is wrong, know the physical consequences of it, and be willing to take that argument anywhere they take you. But most people don't want to do that because they call you names, they call you a bigot or a hater, and very few people have had the courage to stand up to that, I'm sorry to say. But they better find it, because as gay rights laws go in the books, our freedoms are disappearing.
Is it either the complete libertarian, anything goes, government cannot have a concern for any kind of consensual activity as long as it's in the home, or is it either that or the bedroom police?
Well, yeah, that's the formula they're giving us all the time, but the government can make distinctions. The government can lay down markers as to what is healthy behavior and what is unhealthy, or what's immoral and what is moral. So that's what the government has done over the years. But to lift all government authority over sexuality has never been done anywhere in history. I mean, any time a society has lifted the social and political channeling of sex into marriage, a disaster has resulted. When families are devalued, we end up with a situation of a lot of individuals with no particular family ties who don't have allegiance to families and are subject to nothing but outside authority, and this empowers the state. You end up in anarchy, chaos, and finally dictatorship. I know that sounds like a quick trip. You know, people are going to say, my gosh, we're talking gay rights, and now he's talking dictatorships. But there's a clear path, if you look throughout history, for social revolutions to be preceded by sexual revolutions in which family was devalued. Pitirim Sorokin, the founder of Harvard Sociology Department, wrote a book called Crisis of Our Age, and he references his studies and said that he looked in Europe, Asia, Africa, and in many cases, most cases, when a regime was about to fall, a sexual revolution unhinged it and reduced its moral authority. So that may be happening in the United States, but it doesn't have to happen. All you have to do is have a strong remnant of Christians and Jews working together to stand for family values, and I think the truth will come out.
Robert Knight, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you, Todd, for having me on.
Robert Knight is Director of Culture and Family Studies for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in contacting Concerned Women for America, you can either go to their website, that's cwfa.org, cwfa.org, or you can call them at area code 202-488-7000. That's area code 202-488-7000. I would add to the list that Bob had there, not only Christians and Jews, but everyone who believes that homosexuality has crossed the line of public health, has crossed the line of decency, is wrong, and that the government might have something to say about it. When we come back, we'll talk with Scott Klusendorf about the Lacey Peterson and her baby case. Stay with us.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If Christian doctrine can be true or false, can Christian practice also be true or false? Is Christian practice always neutral? What's the relationship between Christian doctrine and Christian practice? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled Doctrine and Practice, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. I've also written an article on the Lord's Supper titled Responding to Real Absence Arguments. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources on issues such as American evangelicalism, church history, biblical interpretation, and much more. Ask to receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on young adults in Romania. This Eastern European country is getting ready to join the European Economic Union in a few years. They'll tie into a monetary system and a values system. The Romanian Missionary Society is saying that leaders in Romania are readily embracing the materialistic and humanistic philosophies of Western Europe. It's described as a welcome change after years of oppressive communist rule, but young Christians are being challenged to lead for the sake of Christ. A key conference recently took place with over 1,000 people in attendance who represented more than 100 evangelical churches. The Romanian Missionary Society sponsored the gathering, which had the theme of Youth of Character with a Pure Life. Pray for Christians in Romania to use their freedoms to proclaim Christ. Get information to pray for people around the world by visiting the internet site missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Got a dragon in your sights? The 13th century Lives of the Saints tells us this. At the town of Cyllene in Libya, there was a dragon who was appeased by being fed 2 sheep a day. When these failed, the townsfolk offered by lot one of their young people. One day the lot fell on the king's daughter, who was led out to the sacrifice, dressed in her wedding gown. George appeared and transfixed the dragon with his spear, and then, using the princess's girdle, led the bemused dragon into the town where it was beheaded. Today is the day of Saint George, patron saint of England, legendary dragon slayer. There's another dragon associated with Saint George. Revelation 12 verse 10 says, "And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth." Christ defeated the power of evil. He cast down the dragon to be slain. What's the dragon, the temptation to evil in your life that you can defeat today? Get a dragon in your sight and slay it. Thanks for listening. I'm Dale Meyer.
Do you need motivation to start an exercise program? Exercise is important to your health, and St. Louis University is conducting research on how to encourage men and women 65 years and older to exercise. Current sessions are being held in North St. Louis County and will teach you how to exercise safely and on your own. You must be 65 years or older to participate and have your own transportation. For more information, contact the St. Louis University School of Nursing.
Welcome back. Scott Klusendorf joins us here in just a moment. He's director of bioethics for Standard Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. We're going to be talking about the Lacey Peterson case. You may have read Cal Thomas recently. Townhall.com ran his article, his column, talking about the Scott Peterson conundrum, in which he has noted, at least in the media, a real trouble figuring out what words to use when it comes to the baby involved in what California is calling a double homicide. Now, California also allows abortion pretty much at will all 9 months. A little inconsistency there, but we'll talk about that during this half hour of Issues Etc. with Scott Klusendorf. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it is always a joy to be with you.
That's nice to hear. I'm glad it's a joy to be here. Let's see if this is good news. Is the fact that Scott Peterson, the husband here in this case, has been charged with double homicide, that of his wife and his unborn child, is this good news for the pro-life movement?
Oh, I think it is. And I think it's important for pro-lifers to look not only at the law, but look at this as a teachable moment for our nation. This brings to the forefront the question, why does location matter? In other words, how can we say that a mere journey of 8 inches down the birth canal suddenly transforms a non-human tissue blob into something we ought to value and respect? How does a simple journey down the birth canal do that? And this case with Lacey Peterson brings that question to the forefront. And even people who are moderately pro-choice, people like Kathleen Parker, a journalist who writes nationally in syndicated columns, is repulsed that someone would suggest that an eight-month fetus is anything less than a full human being. You have other journalists making the same kinds of observations. These are good for us, and it's a limited good, meaning it's not the be-all, end-all. It's not sufficient in itself to make our case, but it's certainly a great step in that direction. The other thing that's good from a legal standpoint is it illustrates the legal absurdity of the law, which is as follows. A woman may not harm her unborn child through drug abuse, alcohol abuse, nor can she kill her unborn child deliberately by trying to hammer her body in order to knock the child out or take some kind of poison internally, but she may kill her child through legalized abortion. Now, that clearly is just absurd, and this case is going to push that hot button as well.
At the same time, that raises a concern in my mind with regard to the state of California, if I could just speak about the entire state in a general way. It seems like they're, in this case, they're having their cake and they're eating their cake. They're retaining a legal abortion virtually at will all 9 months, but they're also having kind of the conscious appeasing a catharsis of being able to charge here in a double homicide under the same legal code.
Well, yeah, and that's an important point, because California law states clearly that you will be prosecuted if you kill a fetus from 7 weeks on, not just a late term, but 7 weeks on. Now, that raises the question, under what circumstances, then, is it justifiable to kill a fetus in California? Well, you hit on the key point. It is justifiable if you're talking about abortion, but it's not justifiable if you're talking about homicide or you accidentally kill a woman who's pregnant. Let me give you an absurd example. Let's say in the state of California, and by the way, this is true of 25 other states. 26 states have fetal homicide laws. California is not the only one. Let's say you're in one of those 26 states and you're a pregnant woman. You're driving to the abortion clinic to have an abortion. En route, you have a traffic accident with the doctor who is scheduled to kill your child 10 minutes later. In that accident, he kills your unborn child. Guess what you're charged with if you're the abortionist? Homicide. And yet, if it had been 10 minutes later, he could have legally killed that child and escaped with no penalty at all.
This raises the question, Scott, of you talked about location. What about the, for lack of a better term, the will of the mother in this case? It seems as though in California, if the mother wants the child, she can have it killed. I mean, if she doesn't want the child, she can have it killed, and that's legal. If she does want the child and the child is killed, it becomes murder.
Yeah, and that's true of federal law in general. If you want to put a nice, neat summary statement on the status of abortion in America today, it is as follows. The child is human and has rights if and only if the mother wants the child. That is the legal, moral, and political standpoint of this nation when it comes to abortion today. People think that because you want the child, that somehow bestows value on it and makes it something we ought not harm. Of course, the homeless are not valued. Does that mean we may kill them? I don't think any of us want to have our value as a human being tied to our ability to win a popularity contest. But that's the principle that's being advanced here, and California is just one of many states that makes it okay to kill a child if it's not wanted, but not okay to kill it if it is.
So how do we respond to someone who is pro-choice, who says that Scott Peterson should be charged with double homicide precisely because Lacey Peterson wanted her baby?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to go about this. Simply ask the question, how does her wanting the child change what it is ontologically? In other words, if I line two women up in front of me, both 8 months pregnant, the way Lacey Peterson was, and woman A doesn't want her child, woman B does, how does the fact that mother A does not want her child make her child any less valuable than mother B's child? Now, they need to answer that from a principled point of view. I mean, the idea that you can kill something that's a human simply, or kill a human being simply because you don't want it, is the foundational basis for genocide the world over. I think people who hold that view have some explaining to do.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the nomenclature here. Cal Thomas, in a recent townhall.com column, notes that the press is having a hard time figuring out what to call this little person. Baby, fetus, unborn baby, unborn fetus. What does this tell you?
Well, I think that people struggle with language when they don't land on a principled position. If you land on a principled position, language is not a problem. So if, for example, I'm dealing with whether or not we ought to treat racial minorities with the same degree of fairness we treat everybody else, and I call someone of a different race a racial epithet, some kind of name, that says to the person listening to me that I do not have a good principled understanding of what makes human beings valuable, and I'm using corrosive language to avoid defending my unprincipled position. And the same thing is happening here with the Lacey Peterson case and with abortion in general. People want to call the unborn something different than it is in order to justify killing it. This is no different than Hitler calling Jews bacilli, in other words, a systemic disease that had to be eradicated through the concentration camp in order to purge Germany of pestilence. This is no different than any other dictator dehumanizing his victim class by making them less than what they are, not through a principled argument, but through mere name-calling. And that's what's going on here. I was amazed, of course, to read the statements of the head of the National Organization for Women for Morris County in New Jersey. What she said in response to this whole Scott Peterson case was, and by the way, her name, ironically, is Marva Stark, which is a great last name for what she said. It labels it perfectly. She said that she was afraid that if Scott Peterson was charged with double murder, this would then make abortion rights fall into jeopardy. Now, what's interesting about that claim is, notice she did nothing to show that the fetus in question was not human. Notice she did nothing to show why, in fact, we shouldn't charge him with double murder, other than to say if that position prevails, her side might lose some points politically and legally, and that would be a bad thing. So what people do who use language is they put politics in front of principle, and that's exactly what we see happening here.
Now, I'm wondering if we might also, given the fact that lawyers are as they are, being given a peek into a possible defense on the part of Scott Peterson, could his defense attorney argue the connection with abortion here and say this should be a single homicide, ergo no death penalty in California?
I think he will argue that. I mean, I'm no lawyer. I can't say that for sure, but I think he could try that. Now, again, he's going to have a problem because California law and 26 other states do have fetal homicide laws on the books, and so far the federal courts have not moved to invalidate those laws. So it could be that there would not be federal precedent for doing that, but I wouldn't be surprised if his lawyer tried it. There is something else here, though, I want to point out, Todd. Although I think there's very good news for pro-lifers here as regards late-term abortion, we must not forget that public support for early abortion remains overwhelmingly strong. The public is indeed repulsed by partial birth abortion, and rightfully so. The public is indeed repulsed by this Lacey Peterson case. They're repulsed by people like the National Organization for Women saying that this wasn't a child and there should only be a single homicide charge. All of that's good news for our side. The bad news is, the reason why support remains high for first trimester abortion, and it's upwards of the high 60s in terms of percentile, the reason that remains high is it's very easy for the public to sympathize with an 8-month baby that they can see, and very difficult for them to sympathize with a first term or first trimester baby that they can't see. And that means that we as pro-lifers must be equipped to argue our case in a principled manner using secular terminology and secular arguments that will resonate with a morally untutored culture.
I think you are fond of, and I think you call it the trot out the toddler argument.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work and how would that help educate the American public with regard to early term abortion?
The great thing about this tactic that we call trot out the toddler is it shows people that the real issue in the abortion debate is not choice, it's not privacy, it's not trusting women to make their own decisions. It's one question: what is the unborn? So when people say to me, for example, well, you pro-lifers just don't trust women to make their own decisions, I trot out an imaginary toddler. I say, imagine I've got a three-year-old in front of me here, and imagine his mother is Andrea Yates, and she wants to drown him in a bathtub. Should we allow her to do it simply because we trust her to make her own decisions about her offspring? Well, of course, the person will say, that's repulsive. How can you say such a thing? Of course she can't do that. And I say, well, why not? Well, because her toddler's a human being. Well, my reply is, ah, then if the unborn in question are human, like that toddler, should we kill the unborn in the name of trusting the mother any more than we'd kill a toddler? Well, no, that's different. The toddler is human, the unborn isn't. Ah, that's the question. Are they the same? Now, notice what this does. It doesn't yet argue that the toddler and the fetus are morally equivalent. We'll do that later. But what it does do is show that that's the issue. It's not about choice. It's not about privacy. It's one question: what is the unborn? And I think this Lacey Peterson case does help us with that. It does focus public attention, at least in the later stages of pregnancy, on what is this thing in the womb. Somehow the rhetoric that this is just a blob of tissue doesn't ring very credible in this case.
So now make that case, Scott, that not only were there two murders here, whoever did it, I mean, it has not been proven that Scott Peterson was the guilty party here, but prove that, make the case that there were two murders here, make the case also, as you said, that the toddler, the hypothetical toddler, and the unborn child are morally equivalent.
Yeah, let me do it scientifically and then philosophically. Scientifically, human embryos are in full possession of the very thing that makes all of us living human beings, and that is the ability of all of our body cells to function together as an organism, as a whole, where the parts serve the larger purpose. In fact, a great way to think of this is we define death as the breakdown of the human body to integrate itself so that all the living parts form a kind of symphony to work together for the common whole. And so a dead person, for example, can have living cells in their body for a couple of hours after death, but it doesn't follow that the person is still alive because the ability of the body to integrate itself is lost. Well, the embryo, from the moment of conception, possesses that ability to integrate its bodily system so that it can live. That's what sets it apart from other living cells of the body that are merely part of the larger human organism. So when we say that scientifically the unborn is alive and is a whole human being, what we mean is not that it's fully developed, not that it has all the bodily systems mature and in place the way it will when it's 21 years old. Rather, we mean that it has that central organizing principle that takes all of the bodily systems and makes it a living, whole organism. Dead people don't have that. Well, from the moment of conception, the embryo does. Then philosophically, I would point out that the relevant difference between fetus and newborn or embryo and newborn, there are differences, but they're irrelevant. They're not important in the way that abortion rights advocates need them to be. Take anything. Take size. Is it true the fetus is smaller than a newborn? You bet. But since when does size have anything to do with the rights people have? You know, Lincoln put it real well. He said, any argument used to disqualify a black person as human will work equally well to disqualify whites. And I'm going to quote Lincoln here generally, almost word for word. He said, you say A is white, B is black. The white man having the right to enslave the dark man? Take care. By that rule, you're a slave to the first person you meet with skin fairer than your own. You say it's not skin color, it's intelligence. The white man having superior intellect to the dark man? Take care again. By that standard, you are a slave to the first person you meet with an intellect superior to your own. You say it's not color, it's not intellect, it's a matter of interest. The white man having it in his interest to enslave the dark man? Take care again. By that rule, you are a slave to the first person you meet who can make it his interest to enslave you. In other words, Lincoln was showing there was no ground in principle whereby you could disqualify a black man as being fully human that wouldn't work equally well to disqualify many people who were not black. And we're doing the same thing here. We're saying give us any standard you want for saying the fetus doesn't count, and we will show you counterexamples that disqualify not only the fetus but those outside the womb. Take consciousness. People say, well, your ability to be self-conscious is what makes you a valuable human being. Oh, really? Well, that not only disqualifies the fetus, that disqualifies newborns. I mean, Peter Singer is correct. Newborns are not self-conscious. Of course, Singer's solution is kill the newborn and the fetus, and I would not hold that view, of course, but he's right about one thing. There's no relevant difference between the fetus and the newborn.
We're talking with Scott Klusendorf, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. Now, if you would like to check out the website for Stand to Reason, simply go to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON. Scott, you have touched upon the issue of personhood, I think, which is the term of art now among those who are trying to argue that while the child from conception may be, yes, alive, maybe, yes, technically, scientifically, genetically, a human being, it's not a person. What do they generally mean by that?
Well, first of all, pro-lifers need to stop the person who says that and make them argue for their view. If you're going to assert that there can be such a thing as a human being that is not a person, I want to hear you make the case that there can be such a thing. I don't know about you, Todd, but have you ever met a human that wasn't a person?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, what do they look like? What disqualifies them? Is it bad breath? They're too tall? They're not developed enough? What is it? Obviously, those would be irrelevant distinctions. So when someone says the unborn are human but they're not persons, that's just a mere assertion. Why should I believe there can be such a thing as a human being that's not a person? They've got to argue for that point, and I think it's very important we not assume the burden of proof there. What the pro-abortionist is trying to get at that point is that your membership in a natural kind, meaning human beings, is not enough to give you value. You only have value after you acquire some arbitrary and accidental property like consciousness, like viability, the ability to feel pain, or some other arbitrary thing they pick up out of thin air. And they have to justify why we ought to accept their arbitrary standard. Why is it self-consciousness that's decisive and not something else? Why isn't it that you aren't human until you qualify to grow nose hairs? Why isn't it that you aren't human until you can pass a kindergarten math test? Why is it that self-consciousness is the standard and not something else? They need to argue for that view, and we need to force them to defend it. Too often, we start getting defensive and trying to say, well, the fetus in the womb can hear music, and we know that parents sing to it. That's all irrelevant. What we need to do is question why that standard they're proposing matters in the first place. We can give a principled, non-arbitrary argument for our view. We can argue that the unborn is alive from the moment of conception. That's beyond dispute. We can argue that it's a member of the human family because it came from human parents. That's beyond dispute. These are facts. What other people want to do is ignore the facts and invent their own subjective, arbitrary standard and then demand that we accept it without ever arguing for it. And I'm not going to let them get away with it.
Is there a way in which the Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson, and the Baby Peterson case could initially be good news? You said it's not an unqualified good. Initially be good news for the pro-life community, but in time prove to be bad news. And this is what I'm suggesting. It kind of comes back to that have your cake and eat it too. That what people would say, what the public would say is, okay, when we got a Scott Peterson kind of a case on hand, then we'll call that double murder. But we'll be perfectly happy to at the same time countenance abortion on demand from beginning until end. We're willing to live with the tension, as long as we can occasionally appease our conscience with a Scott Peterson.
It could go that way. That's certainly possible. I don't think it's plausible. I think more than likely what we're seeing is the public more and more becoming uncomfortable with late-term abortion, but we're seeing very little discomfort regarding first trimester abortion. That's not necessarily bad news in and of itself. It just means we've got to do more work on the first trimester front. Now, I'll tell you what is helping us there, the whole debate over embryo stem cell research and cloning. I mean, imagine if you're an abortion rights advocate. 10 years ago, Clinton was elected. You had a Democratic Congress. You were home free. It was clear sailing. And you were looking at the Freedom of Choice bill being passed in the Congress, and that was just going to slam the door shut on pro-lifers forever. And there was no debate over late-term abortion. It was legal all 9 months, no questions asked. Now, all of a sudden, the public is not only debating partial birth abortion on the late-term end of pregnancy, it's now debating the status of the embryo at the earliest beginnings of pregnancy. So now they're having to fight on two fronts, on both flanks, so to speak. And this is not good news for their side. Now, the caveat for our side is this: are we prepared to defend that embryo in question is a human being, regardless of its tiny size, regardless of its level of development, regardless of its location? We must be willing to make principled arguments to show that differences of location, size, and viability are irrelevant, and that what matters is what you are by nature. Are you a member of the human family? Then that's what matters. You have rights simply because you're human, not because you acquire some property like consciousness.
Scott Klusendorf, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Scott Klusendorf is Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. You can receive Stand to Reason's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling them toll-free, 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON. Now, when you call, ask about their seminar available on video and CD-ROM called Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion. You've heard just a bit here in the course of this conversation with Scott Klusendorf on how it can be done. It's not easy, folks, because it requires that we Christians, number one, do not concede that the burden, that we do not take the burden of proof when it doesn't belong to us, and number two, that we clearly think through all of this before we try and make abortion unthinkable for someone else. You can call now, 1-800-REASON. When we come back from this break, in the second hour of the program, I can't believe it's just been an hour. In the second hour of the program, Bob Liko joins us for an entire hour. Paul Crouch, founder, king, potentate of the Trinity Broadcasting Network, has declared himself even more than that. He has declared himself for the umpteenth time to be a little God, and he's standing by it. He is not misspoken. What does Paul Crouch and what do others mean when they say that they are little gods? And where did this teaching come from? And apparently, we'll get into this with Bob as well in the second hour. The Trinity Broadcasting Network is not working and playing well with its neighbors. We'll find out about that right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.